welcome. Thank you for stopping by. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm from Sweden. And on this program, we discuss some of the most pressing and important issues in our world. Things that people don't know about and issues that in some cases people avoid because it's uncomfortable, politically incorrect, or simply too controversial. We are ultimately truth seekers. We want to know and we want to learn about reality, nature, and human nature in order to better understand why things are the way they are, and of course what we can do to prevent it from going in the direction that the establishment and the globalists want to take this world. There are so many lies and fabrications out there, especially when it comes to our history, but also of course in the media. The media is controlled and the politicians claiming to run things are too. That's why we try to dispel these myth makers and give you not only a different view, but one that actually will help you to understand our world better. The website where you can find more is redicecreations.com. We do regular radio programs 3 times per week. We also do insight videos, TV episodes. Also, of course, check out Radio 314 with Lana. We also have a frequently updated news section. Today, our guest is Patrick LeBrun. He is a writer and activist who has written many articles for Countercurrents Publishing. He has extensive experience with the French identitarian movement. He is based in the United States, but travels regularly to France, and he also mentors college students who wish to engage in activism. Our topic today is going to be on the terrorist attacks on the Charlie Hebdo paper in Paris and the shootings of the police officer and the hostage drama at the kosher market that also ended very violently. Patrick has a, a unique view on the events, and he brings some very interesting material to the table here today that I think we should look much closer at. Both the ideas of false flag attacks or sting operations are not foreign concepts to Patrick, but we are going to discuss some of the things that the conspiracy movement and the alternative news websites out there have jumped on, perhaps prematurely, and look at the possibility that we might be dealing with a genuine, bona fide attack. If we put this in the right geopolitical light and understand the dynamics in France as well, we might understand a little bit better what happened and why. Welcome, Patrick. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You bet. Now, I think you have a unique perspective on the Paris shootings. You've not only spent a lot of time in France, you know a lot of people over there. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about what you think our audience should know about the topics we're going to talk about here today as they relate to you, Patrick, and your background?
Sure. Well, I'm a dual citizen between France and the United States. I've spent about a third of my life in France, and I think that my ability to look at original source material in French is going to add a bit to this discussion about what really happened in the Charlie Hebdo massacre and in the kosher market massacre that followed, as well as the attempt by the elites to spin the story, as they always do, in a way that benefits them and their longer-term goals.
Very good. Now, of course, one of the main themes here, we're talking a bit about this before the show, but, you know, there's a lot of conspiracies going around about this. A lot of people jump on this right away. They're determined it's a false flag, and then they're kind of just setting out to prove it. For this one, I've been more hesitant just to kind of, I'm always like that on these events, though. I really want to know, you know, what happened? Did it happen in the way we thought it would happen? And I think that's important for everyone to do, no matter, you know, what beliefs one has. I think it's more important to realize, as you said, how is it going to be used by the elite? But what do you think about the event if we compare it with, you know, other conspiracy theories, other false flags of the past? What category did you put this in, Patrick?
Right. Well, what I'm seeing in the American alternative media milieu is that there are essentially two camps. One is that, you know, those who say that it's always Mossad in Israel are saying it's always Mossad in Israel, and those who say it's everybody but them are trying to push back against it, but overall the general push seems to be that, yeah, this is a Mossad-Israel attack. And this is understandable considering the role of Israel and the community that supports it in the world. And when you think about the threat that was given to France after they recognized Palestine last fall, it was very vague and very bizarre, and something you don't see often between countries. That is that Netanyahu said that France will have grave consequences for their choice to recognize Palestine. And so for those who see, okay, there's the threat, And then they say, who benefits? Obviously, Israel does, because it means more Western armies in their immediate neighborhood, fighting the people who could threaten their security. And it also means a lot more of the Jewish diaspora moving back to Israel. However, I would say that's not quite what happened here. And at the same time, I'd have a different view than the establishment, which wants to pin it on ISIS or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Hey, just a side note here. I don't want to get lost in this one, but Sweden actually recognized Palestine early in October last year, or late in October, sorry, last year. And the kind of the same critique was aimed, obviously, from Israel towards Sweden. And there's also kind of a bizarre sidestep by the new, socialist democratic government that came into place. Our Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, has basically just, did this on a fly. And then, of course, Israel warned us or warned Sweden. And now there's been this a little bit of a battle back and forth here between one of the she's actually a foreign minister, sorry, Margot Wallström, that she won't be protected if she actually comes and visit Israel and stuff like that. But interestingly enough, we did have a bombing of a justice center in Malmö, basically in December, about 1 month after that, which is, of course, Malmö is the community city most dominated by Muslims in Sweden. And it didn't become much of it, but it was just an interesting little corollary there between what happened with Sweden and what potentially might have happened in Paris. Don't know if you have any comments on that, Patrick.
Right. I think there was a similar thing with the Breivik attack as well, right? Wasn't there also some kind of recognition of Palestine before that?
Well, the thing is there, I think people jumped a little bit too much on the gun. They need to understand the Nordic countries. They had a, you know, kind of a socialist get-together camp, as they do everywhere. It's like every year, it's like the young people of the upcoming, you know, socialist democratic parties. They have these, you know, yearly meets at different places. They go out and camp and stuff like that. We have those in Sweden too. I think Denmark have those regularly. And they're very common that the left-leaning, these left-leaning groups have these anti-Israeli kind of, you know, smaller demonstrations, or they do something about it. So I don't think it was, to be honest, it's not that big of a deal, because they do it all the time and people decided to connect it just there and then. I think it's more interesting what Breivik talked about, how openly supportive he was of Zionism. But who knows, right? It's difficult for me to say how deep this goes, but we still have to figure out what the reasoning would be why Israel and potentially the Mossad would go in and do an operation like this in order to, I don't know, punish the country. I'm struggling a little bit to see what they would seek to get out of it. You know what I mean?
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and this is, I guess you say this is something that happens often, that there are these kinds of demonstrations. It's hard to say that that's the case, though, because, you know, in Beirut or Cairo, people are happy to say who benefits, and as soon as they answer that, they feel they've gotten to the bottom of the matter. I think for us, we should hold ourselves to a higher standard. I know that Red Ice Radio and its listeners hold themselves to a higher standard, because I think this is the only show in the alternative media that is giving multiple sides of the story and giving air to and space for discussion. Could I open and close the book on Israeli involvement on this one? I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I think that there are a number of things that would rule it out. And I think also just ruling out that this is a intelligence-controlled project as well is possible. I would point to false flag attacks of the past. And I think the one that would be the most obvious, the most open and shut case would be that of the underwear bomber.
Yeah.
This was a guy whose father had warned the U.S. Embassy that his son was being radicalized. There were numerous people who blew the whistle on him. He was definitely being watched and followed. And he ends up traveling from Ghana to Amsterdam, switching flights, being led by a man who is seemingly an employee of the airport security. He's walked past the metal detectors. He's brought to a stewardess, and he doesn't have a passport, but he gets on the plane. This is pretty bizarre. And yeah. Also, the excuse that was given by the security man was that, he's coming from, I think he said Somalia or Ethiopia or one of these places. And anyone who knows Africa and Africans knows that this young guy, Omar Abdul-Muttalib, he looks West African. And when you go to Somalia, when you go to Ethiopia, they look very different, right?
Yeah.
And so first, it's a bit silly that they thought this guy was actually from East Africa. They let him on the plane. According to eyewitnesses, he was filmed the entire time by someone a few rows back with a camera, which, you know, try getting away with filming on a plane yourself and see what happens.
Right.
And then his and I think this is the key point, his bomb didn't work. And when there was the arrest afterwards, two people were brought off the plane with in handcuffs. And then after that, when one of the people who was on the plane spoke to the Detroit Free Press the next day and gave them the story, he was threatened by the FBI. And luckily, he had the courage to come back to the press again and say, hey, I've been threatened by the FBI about this. And so this has all the marks of a typical kind of operation that the FBI runs, where they find someone who's easy to influence, who's radicalizing. And in fact, 95% of the attacks, 95% of the arrests by the FBI since 9/11 have been people who were groomed and in cells that were led by employees of the FBI, whether they were actual agents or someone on the payroll of the agency.
Yeah. Well, pretty incredible.
Yeah. If anyone Googles 95% of arrests since 9/11, they'll find these studies. And it came out, I think, at the end of 2013. And this really fits that. And also the same weekend, they rounded up, I think it was two or three other cases that were similar to this. Two of them were actually converts. They were European Americans who converted, I believe. And they were, you know, same story. They were in a cell that was being led by an employee of the FBI. They were walked through how to build a bomb. They were taken to a federal building. Then they were given the phone, okay, dial this number, that'll make it blow up. And then as soon as they dial the number, then they put the handcuffs on the guy and arrest him for terror charges. So this seems to fit that as well. And then, of course, the next day we had the second head of the Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, coming out and had the solution for the problem, which happened to be the solution was naked body scanners produced by a company that he sat on the board of.
Wasn't it like Chertoff Group or something like that even?
Straight is that right? Yeah.
I believe so. Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm not going to benefit from this at all. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I give you a good price. Right? Yeah. One of these things, yeah. So this is a very fishy thing. And I think people are – I think this we should look for these kind of things when we look for a false flag. I would contrast that with the attack by – not the attack, the arrest of Najibullah Zazi. This was a guy who was in the suburbs of Denver, Colorado. He was a taxi driver. He came from Afghanistan, and he was, you know, for all appearances, in a sleeper cell. Now, it's very normal when an intelligence service thinks that someone's in a sleeper cell to wait and not arrest them, because you want to find out who he works for, how does money get transferred to him, all these things. I think the same thing would be done by, you know, drug distributors who are above the bottom street level. They try to, if they feel like, okay, maybe we can pull the string here and we can find our way back to the mastermind or our way back to the big financier and have an even bigger impact than if we were to just arrest them immediately.
Right.
Now he was under very close surveillance. And then suddenly one night he just takes a road trip nonstop across the country to New York City. And there was essentially panic because he slipped his washers, didn't know where he was. And so they were immediately trying to round up the rest of the sleeper cell. They're doing it in an incredibly sloppy way. And they did it in a way that I believe they actually outed one of their guys in the community, the Muslim community of New York, who was basically an informant for them. You know, sitting in a mosque and chatting with people and mm-hmm. saying who was, you know, talking radical and that sort of thing. And they also unveiled that one of their guys was a double agent. You know, they said, all right, now it's time for you to act. We need you to find these people. And then he was caught going around the neighborhood, you know, telling people, okay, if you see this guy, tell him to get the hell out. So the kind of, you know, chaos of the response you saw and the kind of yeah, just that it didn't have that feel of this other attack, I think. And also this one was not, in the end, luckily, there was no attack made. But it didn't have the same environment, I think, or things going into it as the Omar Abdulmutallab attack.
Yeah, pretty amazing how many of these, sting operations and everything else that they're seeking to entrap people within to put blame on. That I'm always very curious, you know, what goes on in these people's, you know, heads. I know some people advocate and say, you know, they're conditioned in some way, you know, I guess mind control would be one term that some people use, due to the fact that their willingness in some cases to sacrifice themselves and actually to die for it, while at the same time knowing that they're, you know, working for, intelligence services. It's very strange to me. I've yet to figure that out. I don't know anybody who has, but that means we can't pin it down just to ideology alone, obviously, some of these events. They're completely driven of different agendas, right?
Right. Yeah. My point of view would be that almost no one is willing to die for an intelligence agency, and that there are a lot of people who are willing to die for Islam or other causes. Except, yeah, I think maybe unless you're someone who grew up in the society and you're, let's say, very invested in the survival of the state of Israel, or I think people who are actually agents of the intelligence agency, I should be specific here. If you are an asset of the intelligence agency and you come from another country, I think you're very unlikely to want to die for it. I think that those who do die for it are either tricked into it or they believe they're dying for something else.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that we could see, you know, this would give us a sense of the, in this case, where it falls on that spectrum, right? Between, you know, sort of an open and shut case of a false flag and one that where you see the response to the establishment looks like it's not so much that. But yeah, I think also we want to talk about how Israel false flags work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The most famous of those would be the Levant affair in Egypt. And then their bombings in Baghdad, and in both cases, so in the Levant affair, what they wanted to do was to stop the departure of colonial powers from Egypt, and they were going to give the impression that that those who were going to take over would be inheriting chaos. They would be inheriting a country in which the communists and the Islamists were jostling for power and bombing and shooting. Now, none of these attacks that they had planned, and most of it was the operation was rolled up and exposed by the Egyptians before it even took place. None of them involved Jewish deaths. And for the Baghdad bombings, this was a case of where they wanted to push the Jewish population of Baghdad, which was the largest population of or largest concentration of Jews in the world, and probably had been since the time of the the end of the Second Temple, and we get them to move to Israel because there was a window of time where they had convinced the regime in Iraq to allow Jews to leave, but it was a very costly departure because if they were to leave, they would have to pay for leave behind all of their assets. They couldn't be absentee landlords of a property when they leave town. They couldn't, and also that means they're not going to get a very good price.
Right.
Essentially, they have to start from scratch when they move to Israel. So they're leaving behind a lot of comfort, a lot of wealth. It's and for something that's very uncertain. And also, at that time, Israel was really known to be a place where the Ashkenazi were in charge, and the Sephardic Jews, who were the Arab speaking and looking Jews, were kind of second class citizens.
Right. Yeah.
And so. These bombings took place during that window of time when they were allowed to leave to create a level of tension that would push them to leave. There was only one death, though, of several bombings. There were, grenades thrown or car bombs outside of synagogues and Jewish libraries. And that was because of and that was clearly an accident because a high-powered wire broke and electrocuted a small boy playing outside. So it was this, you had a sense of danger. There was, explosions, there was physical, violence against property, and there was the sense that, okay, next time they're actually going to hit us. But in fact, it never really hurt any of the, with one exception by accident, they weren't killing Jews to scare Jews, right?
Right, yeah.
So, I think that's important to consider here, because, before we dive into some of the details of the attacks, seven Jews died, four at the, at the kosher grocery store, and I believe at least three at Charlie Hebdo. If I want to win points with some of your listeners who are not liking this debunking road I'm going down, I'll point out that that's already more than the number of Israeli citizens who died in the World Trade Center on 9/11.
Right. Wow.
So.
Yeah. So, in other words, and we'll, of course, go through this a little bit more and analyze this and see, you know, how you've reasoned around this and why you think, you know, why things, you know, happened in the way they did. Should we take a kind of a look then at some of the holes in the story that we've seen going around, the official story? Because one asset that you said here that you have is that you can actually, you know, you can check the French news channels and you can, you know, read the papers and the online articles and everything, which is, of course, one aspect where you do get a lot of reporting in the native language, but all of it is not going to be translated over to English. So everyone won't be able to understand everything that all the discussions and everything that goes on locally in France, right?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's just listen to a clip here to kind of set off some of the things we wanted to talk about of how certain things have spread through not only the alternative media but the mainstream media. Let's listen to this first clip here.
Il y avait une jeune journaliste, une jeune contributrice de Charlie Hebdo qui a eu la Kalachnikov sur le nez et il lui a dit récite le Coran et je t'épargne. Et elle récitait ça en boucle. Elle disait il m'a dit ça. Il avait très beaux yeux bleus. Il m'a dit ça. De très beaux yeux. Je sais plus.
So what this is? First of all, this is Caroline Forest or Caroline Forest. She's a famous and in certain circles a popular public intellectual. She's linked with the Femen group and probably linked with George Soros funding, but she's been around a lot longer than that. She's had also to pull books back from the shelves because she's fabricated stories. She's taken stories about out of one book about one radical Muslim and put it in a book about a conservative Muslim and pretended that this was an account of something he did, right? And she was caught doing this red-handed, and she had to actually take her books back from the bookstores and get it replaced. She created a documentary that was against conspiracy theories, particularly about 9/11, and played very fast and loose with some logical fallacies to try and discredit anyone who puts into question the official story or puts into question the response of the U.S. and NATO since then, and of course, Israel. Now, here what she's doing, and she often relies on, I spoke to this person who said this, or I spoke to a lawyer who said this. And here she's saying, I spoke to a journalist who was there who said to me that they put this gun in my nose, they told me to recite the Quran, I recited it over and over. And then she switches perspective from the third person to the first person of the woman. And she says, il m'a dit, that means he said to me, you have very pretty eyes, or you have pretty eyes, I don't know anymore. And now the way it's been translated is not from il m'a dit, but elle a dit, which would be that she had said he had very pretty eyes. This was this blue eyes meme has caught on, and the fact that it happens very quickly, the fact that she's switching perspective and she's kind of treating it like throwaway lines, makes it hard to I think for some to really get at what she's saying. But if you hear it, if you listen to it again on the original, it's very clear. Il m'a dit. So that's a meme that began also after the Mohamed Merah attacks, and this was leading up to the presidential election. There were a number of anonymous sources who said, oh, this guy had blue eyes. This was after some Mohamed Merah's attacks we can get into later, but there was an attempt in the media to blame the extreme right, to have an impact on the presidential elections. And as it turned out, it was a homegrown, born in France, Algerian, who really, really hated France and French people, and he was clearly the one who did these attacks. This is really the source of that. Now I can tell you that the actual woman who the journalist who was there was a situation. If your listeners have seen the show Homeland, I think in the last season they had a similar situation. This is a TV show about the CIA. They were based in Pakistan in the American embassy. And they were all in the crisis room. And the terrorists had come, and they had a young lady, and they were going to kill her in front of the camera just outside the crisis room if they didn't open the door, right? Mm. Something very similar happened there, and that is that one of the employees of Charlie Hebdo, she left mid-afternoon to or midday to go pick up her daughter from you know, like a day school sort of thing or a preschool sort of thing, and she was bringing her back. And as these guys were outside the door, they had a security system in place at Charlie Hebdo because this is a group that's already been firebombed. They are repeatedly threatened with attack. They pulled the gun on her daughter, according to her, and they said, "We'll kill you and your daughter if you don't let us in." And then she let them in. And so she put in the code, and that's when the massacre began. And they let her live. And she was told, "I will let you live so that one day you can read the Quran." So there's a bit of difference between her direct account. It seems to be this is the account that Caroline Forrest is riffing off of, and is misrepresenting because I don't know what she was really going for, saying that, you know, that you have very pretty eyes, that a killer would say that to a woman. Is it this anti-rape culture thing or something about male domination that she was wanted to highlight? I'm not quite sure.
Right.
But these are subjects that are near and dear to her heart and that she wanted to she'll inject at any time that she can.
Yeah, to advance her own agenda. Again, using it like everyone is seeking to use it, right? So
interesting.
Yeah. By the way, just mention that I know the TV series is a little bit different, Homeland. I know that there's a couple of different writers on that, but I believe it's based on the book Prisoners of War by Gideon Ruff, whatever his last name is, which is he's Israeli. He even worked together with the director of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I forget the director's name, but it was basically out in the open that he was working in Hollywood as an Israeli intelligence asset, basically.
Right.
Yep, there's a couple of films that he worked on, and he's very close with this guy as well. So we obviously can understand that there's a because this Homeland series is basically taking all the things that never actually happened with the war on terror and kind of making that a mental reality for a lot of people that are actually watching it, you know?
Right, right. I tried it was also a very successful TV show in Israel. I tried watching it, but it was incredibly slow and incredibly emotional and sappy, and so I only made it through the second episode, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So what about the car and the ID and all that?
Right. The first theory I heard was that the ID was found in a car that was different from the car filmed at the attack site, because the car filmed at the attack site had white rearview mirrors, and the car where the ID was found and where cameras came and filmed it did not have white rearview mirrors. And so this is something that is very easy, though, to do with your car. Every time a car is detailed or a new car that's sent from the factory to a dealership will have white plastic over a lot of the parts of it, like the rearview mirrors, the hood, the roof, the trunk. And these are just to keep it a bit fresher. It's a very easy, quick way for them to change the appearance of their car to make it less likely after they abandon it that it will be searched. Because if you park a car in an area, it's reasonable that it would take days and days before anyone actually searches the car. That it would be just collecting parking tickets over time before someone finally says, "Okay, what's the deal with this car?"
Right.
Now, how they ID'd that car as one that needed to be searched, I'm not sure. Maybe someone saw the guys changing in the car before they switched to their new getaway car. But somehow they decided that we needed to search this car. It's very easy to remove these white covers on the rearview mirrors. And then there's the question of the ID inside. Now, like most of your listeners, I immediately thought of the passport at the World Trade Center.
Yeah. Of course.
And that's a story that, of course, stinks to high heaven, right?
Yeah.
But the path of the passport is a lot more miraculous than the path of this ID. The path of the passport is that it has to survive the impact into the building. It has to survive I think, was it hours of burning in fire on the floors where the plane impacted. And then it has to survive the largest building destruction in all of history to be found intact in a very short period of time while lower downtown New York is still covered in rubble.
Yeah.
For this to have happened with the idea of one of the Kawachi brothers to be found, all that has to happen is on the most nerve-wracking day of his life, when he's doing the most intense thing he's ever done in his life, that he forgets to change his wallet from his old pants to his new pants. Right? Now, it's a dumb mistake. There were several dumb mistakes that they made in this, and there are several smart things that they did in this. They seem to be very comfortable with weapons and running. And when they ran around very naturally. However, they also knocked on the wrong door when they came first to the Charlie Hebdo offices.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. When you see the famous video of them shooting the police officer when they're getting back in their car, one of the guys opens the door, the passenger, and his shoe drops out. And he has to pick up his shoe and pull it back in. Because when he changes out of his tactical gear into his civilian gear, he had these all by his feet, I guess. So then, and these fell out. And so there's a bit of bumbling, and there's a bit of level of comfort that they have. And so this is something that seems within the realm of possibilities that you forget this. It is also the brother who had a lot less training. This is Saeed Kouachi, whereas Sharif Kouachi was much more of a hardened criminal. He had more training. He was much more of a dedicated terrorist, whereas Saeed was definitely a dedicated Islamist. But in terms of his tactical capabilities, there's lots of reason to believe that he was the lesser of the two, even though he's he happens to be the older brother. But he seems to be less capable than his other brother.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So they continued on the run, and actually, it's worth visiting that police effort as well, because I think this is probably the biggest and the last of the holes in the official story, right? So it seems that after they attacked it's actually filmed. After they attacked Charlie Hebdo, which is kind of on a side street, they started driving the wrong way down a one-way street towards the Greenway. As bad luck would have it, a police car was coming right in their direction. Now, I didn't see the lights flashing on it, so I'm not sure if it came specifically for the shootings or not, or if it was just doing a regular drive-through. The brothers immediately stepped out of the car and opened fire towards the police car. The police car backed up wisely because, you know, facing down the kind of weapons these brothers had, it's not worth crouching down behind a car door, right? So they backed up and into the main street. The brothers then pulled forward. They parked on that main street along the Greenway. They ran towards the cop that they shot a cop, it injured him, and then there's the famous film of them running towards him and shooting him, and then running back towards the car. And so, like a lot of your viewers, again, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, where's the blood? You know, this is
right.
The same as these beheadings in Syria, right? I mean,
yeah.
Some of them are you know, I haven't seen that many, but, you know, when it was pointed out that Foley didn't have a lot of blood in his video, I watched it, and, you know, and I've seen these things from before, certainly earlier in the earlier years of the war on terror, these videos, and it's like, wow, yeah, these are not, this doesn't fit. This doesn't fit, right? There's just not enough blood there. So, you know, the Red Ice Radio listeners are, I think they deserve an extra effort, and so what I did in preparation for this was I called an old friend of mine who, during his residency rotations as a doctor, he worked as an autopsist. And so I talked with him about this. Now, he said that it's certainly within the realm of possibility that, say, the bullet bounced on the sidewalk and lodged into his vertebrae or something like this, and it could stop there in a way that would break his spinal cord, so he would fall to the ground, but that it wouldn't hit an artery, so he wouldn't have gushing blood, right?
Right, yeah.
Now, there are many stories. I think if anyone who's listened to cops or soldiers tell stories, especially cops, I think, because soldiers are using a larger caliber, or they have only a certain, they have a different way of engaging with the enemy, whereas cops limit they see limited shooting compared to a military. But they'll tell a lot of stories about the bizarre paths that bullets will take. Also because cops have to answer these questions about where did a bullet go, how did it bounce around. So the autopsist made the comparison for me to the Oscar Grant case. This was a young black man in Oakland who was being arrested and on the platform of their regional train. And the cop and this was filmed, and the cop who thought he was reaching for a taser apparently actually reached for his gun, and while he was sitting on top of him, shot him in the back. And what happened was the bullet went through his body down to the ground, then bounced up, and then hit him in the heart and lodged in a rib. And he was saying that, you know, if the bullet had not bounced that way, like say he was just, you know, if the bullet had gone through that exact trajectory, but then just kept going in that same direction, it would, the young man would not have died. It was because of the bounce into a vital organ that he died. And so, you know, bullets do lots of strange things. I think we'll never really know the story. Also, the autopsist told me that I should speak with an EMT as well, who would be able to answer these questions. I can tell you that I called numerous fire departments and also EMT trainers, and the only ones who got back to me were EMTs from companies that just cart old people from one place to another, saying, you know, we don't do this, we don't know how how this stuff plays out.
Right.
So, and I'm not sure that any of them will respond, because I think anything that touches on conspiracy theories, they're, you know, even debunking it, I think they're a little bit cautious to give an opinion or talk to a stranger about
sure.
these things.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But
so the point here to carry is that, you know, yes, we do have stories like, you know, the magic bullet of JFK, which seems
right.
implausible, but that doesn't mean that you don't have bullets behaving strangely once inside of the body, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess I would say here that the things to add together to add to a complete picture for me, and I'll leave it up to your audience to decide for themselves, is that it is in the realm of possibilities that it would have taken more than 10 seconds for the blood to cover the sidewalk. And there are, you know, films that were made after the fact where there is blood shown on the sidewalk after the cop was taken away.
And off, just pause button there for a second. Let me interject this. There was one clip as well that people pulled up, because I think it was a BBC or a reporter on site that said that the blood was put there. I don't know if you saw
right.
that one. And then, of course, people realize that, oh, my God, he's in on it too, right? So he just... but I think same thing there, actually, in all the sincerity. I think it's one of those things when you stand in the live broadcast and do things, you do flub up.
Right.
I mean, it fits perfectly into the narrative, of course, of what people want to hear there, too, which is kind of interesting. But it doesn't mean that he was in on it and know that someone went and poured blood on it.
Right.
I don't think so, anyway. So
that's an excellent point. And you know, when you look at this video, he's talking about candles. He talks about flowers. And then he talks about blood. And so he's talking about, you know, a thing that's put, a thing that's put, and a thing that's not put, but then he says it's put there.
Yeah.
So, is it a normal flub? You know, yeah. Now, if for him to be an insider, now for things like this that are done covertly or clandestinely, right, a journalist from a foreign country will never be an insider. Right, and certainly not one that comes up and does the on-scene thing.
Mm.
Now, did he stand around and overhear the cops saying, "Oh, don't forget to put the blood down before we take the body away"?
Right.
Yeah, he wasn't there when that happened. And the cops wouldn't have let him near when that was happening. If this was put there, this guy wouldn't know about it. I think it was a flub.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's the, you know, it's in the realm of possibility that it would have taken a while for the blood to come out. And then there's the tactical impossibility that these guys use real bullets inside Charlie Hebdo and fake bullets outside.
Right. I was actually thinking about that too, because, you know, one of the problems that arise if we take the account that he was not shot, the police officer, then, you know, these are real people. They live mm-hmm. real lives. They have families. They're, you know, paying their mortgages and their bills and whatnot. It would basically be a deal here where he would decide to go to you know, False Flag Island and live out the rest of his life, you know, in a hammock with a you know, drink in his hand or something like that.
Yeah, I love that line, False Flag Island. I'm definitely going to use that in the future.
Because that's what it's got to be, right? I mean, if they're in on it, then they go somewhere, and that's strange. I mean, because the brother was speaking out right afterwards, it would basically mean that they would also either know about it, or he would basically say, or decide not ever to see his own family again, which is hard to believe over something like this, isn't it?
Right. Right, absolutely, and on top of that, you know, if the plan was from the beginning, okay, we need to mobilize the French population to be upset about Islam and its attack on our way of life, let's say. Well, no one is, you know, very few people are standing in the streets saying "Je suis un policier," like I'm a cop, right? Everyone's saying "Je suis Charlie." This cop was really in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, this is not. If there was an overall script, this little detail would add a lot of risk for the intelligence agency putting this script together without any gain.
Right.
You know, there's really nothing extra that they get for it, that you know, having killed a cop on their way out of the area. So, and also I'd point out too, both of the attacks occurred very close to where these brothers grew up and spent their entire lives. The 11th arrondissement is where the 11th arrondissement, 19th and 20th are all bordering, and they're all in the east of Paris, and they're all much more working class and have heavy immigrant populations. And particularly for the 19th and 20th, you know, when you watch the municipal elections return their results, the only question is like, well, will the socialists finally unseat the communists this year? Because it's about, you know, 50% communists, 40% socialists in the 20th, mm-hmm. something like this.
Right.
And so, and every other party is almost non-existent there. And so that gives you a sense of the neighborhood itself. And so this was a terrain that these guys would be very familiar with. And so they snuck away in their cars. They drove only a few hundred meters. They changed on the way in the car, and then they immediately got out into their other car and then left the city into the countryside.
That's one of the shoes fell out of the front seat there too. I was wondering what the hell is a shoe does right there. I don't know if you saw that in the footage. It was like someone said there was a marker or something like that, but you know, yeah.
Yeah, this shoe was the one that he probably ran out of town with, and when they were running around the woods, he was wearing that shoe because they left behind their tactical gear, which would definitely have drawn attention to them.
Sure, you know,
wherever they would have gone. And so there's a big question. Did they really want to escape, or is this when they also enter into the not-so-professional area? Because they definitely wanted to have a multi-day terror unroll during these attacks. The Coulibaly attack began 2 days after, and it seems that that was done so that the efforts of the anti-terror police and the SWAT teams would be divided, and it would give a better chance at the brothers to make their escape. But then they really didn't get that far. They went in probably the absolute wrong direction if they wanted to cross the border discreetly. It would have been much better if they had gone all the way across the country to Spain or in the other direction to Italy. But the obvious route that would be very surveilled and the easier route to surveil for the state is the crossings into Belgium. And numerous people who were targeted as jihadis or who were unveiled as being part of plots in the past, they've always tried to make their escape through Belgium, and they are always caught. The exception would be when, this is before the attacks took place, but Coulibaly, he drove his wife and some other family down to Spain, and it was from Spain that they flew to Turkey and made their escape to Syria.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's an open question. Did they really want to escape, or did they want to go down in glory? They definitely wanted to call the BFM TV, which is kind of like a Bloomberg or CNBC, to give their account, to tell their tale. And they definitely wanted, and Coulibaly, while he was in the kosher market, was definitely watching the television on that channel, waiting for them to appear. And then he called after them in order to give his two cents as well.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So the last thing I want to address, I guess, of all the YouTube conspiracy theories that have been spread, is that Hollande called these attackers Illuminati.
Mes chers compatriotes, la France a été attaquée 3 jours de suite. Ceux qui ont commis ces actes, ces terroristes, ces illuminés, ces fanatiques n'ont rien à voir avec la religion musulmane.
So he's saying, yeah, these attacks that happened 3 days ago, they were caused by illuminés, right? Now, illuminés, if you were to talk about in the early 19th century or late 18th century, I know when he had Jeeva Singhanand on the radio on your show, he talked about les illuminés as lodges in France, right?
Yeah.
And now that was the way this word was used in the past, and it's also returned to French through Illuminati historians, let's say, or theorists. Now, the way that it's been used, though, for the past few decades is, ironically, it's used as, say, someone who puts their finger in a light socket and is crazy, right? With, like, imagine frizzy hair sticking out and this kind of thing.
Right.
This is an illuminé. If your listeners were to look on freedictionary.com or a number of other, translation sites, they would see that, this word is used for, lighting something up, and the slang is for a crazy person, right? And besides, it really wouldn't make any sense that in this, for him to say that these people are Illuminati in the kind of environment that there is. And why would he try to pin Illuminati status onto these enemies of civilization if he's also a tool of the Illuminati himself, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's another one of those things where it's like a false friend between one language or another. It's like when it's two things. It's one is that the words sound, the words are different from one language to the other. Like in English, you say embarrassed, but in Spanish, if you say embarazada, that means pregnant, right?
Right. Yeah.
Or if you were to think of the word, 50 years ago, if somebody said that guy, he's a little queer. You would think he was just was a bit strange,
Yeah,
whereas
okay,
now,
right?
Yeah, now it means very specifically that the person is a homosexual.
Mm.
And so, this is one of those things where ask any native French speaker, and they'll tell you that he was saying that these people are crazy, and that's unfortunately the stance that a lot of the political class is taking, is that they don't take terrorists at their word, that they actually have a belief system, that they're actually motivated to change the world, and they're willing to risk their lives or lose their lives to do it. I take them at face value when they say that that's what they want, and they say this is their vision of the world. I think, yeah, okay, that's what they want to see. And the fact that they do things that I find morally objectionable doesn't necessarily mean that they're crazy. It means that,
sure,
I need to do everything I can to stop them.
Yeah.
But that's not the goal of the government now. They don't want to do everything they can do to stop this from happening, because the obvious thing would be to stop the problem of mass replacement immigration into France.
Right. Yeah.
And this is something that for their political masters, for their paymasters, this is something that has to continue at all costs.
So it's a reflection of course, how foreign it is to most people in Europe and the West to sacrifice yourself for an ideology. We're not just used to doing that. So instead of kind of accepting that and realizing that this is part of the problem, they choose to pin it on just a couple of, that's the conspiracy, right? It's just a lone nut.
Right.
So therefore, that's whatever behavior we've had or the fact that we have a hand in enabling this even to be remotely possible, we're never going to put attention to that, right? Because that would be to admit that what they have created with multiculturalism is a massive failure and has led to situations like this. So it's interesting. They're kind of, they're in between, sandwiched between, like, which puts them in a nowhere position, really, because at least the conspiracy camp is like, okay, this is done by the intelligence services, this is it that's happening, and those who object are like, all right, this is just, full-on jihadists, this is what it is. The government is trying to, like, figure it out somewhere in between, which kind of leaves them nowhere, really, to be able to do anything about it either.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I have conversations with a lot of, you know, everyone I know or has, you know, different opinions about politics. Very, very few would share my own, who I deal with on a daily basis and you know, business and social life. And so I hear one of these popular theories is that, well, you know, these young guys, they just don't have any money and they don't get enough sex. And when I hear this, I think, well, you know, what you're saying is telling me a lot more about yourself and your motivations than, you know, a serious evaluation of these young men whose lives are so different from yours, whose level of dedication to a cause is so different than yours.
Yeah.
People always want to project their own emotions, their own motivations on others.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in a very soft and decadent culture, it is impossible to understand what drives these young men.
Yep, very good point.
Yeah.
All right, should we move on to the kosher market, Koulibaly?
Sure thing, yeah. So this happened shortly after. Now, Koulibaly seems to have done a couple of other things. He seems to have set fire to a car, which at first it was assumed this is just another car burning, you know, just a usual, typical French suburban car burning, which is every year there's a tradition the day after New Year's to count the number of cars burnt and to compare the year-to-year evolution of that as a measure for the level of civility in society. You know, so he set fire to this car. He also shot a black female police officer, and then he took over the kosher market. When he ran inside, he killed three of the people who were there shopping. And then he basically shut it down, took it over. A number of them ran downstairs and hid. There was just the one of the workers there. He escaped on a sidewalk elevator that moves goods in and out of the basement. And that's another story that's fed into the official story that might be interesting to explore. So after he shot the three shoppers, he took control of the store. Some of the shoppers ran down into the basement. He took out, according to the eyewitnesses, he took out a USB key from his GoSport camera, which was filming the events, and he uploaded it online through a laptop that he was carrying in a backpack. I don't think that we've seen this footage yet, but no doubt it will be part of a recruitment video for jihadis in the near future. He then broke the cameras and set up a few booby traps around the store. And then suddenly he was very relaxed. Now, in the basement, what happened, and this is another story, that is that a young African man was working there. Basically, when the people came down, they told him what was happening. And according to him, he put them in the fridge, and then he went out on an elevator shaft out on the sidewalk. This became kind of something that the media really enjoyed talking about afterwards, because they wanted to make it seem he was a righteous among the nations, that here was a good Muslim, a good African, who was hiding the Jews and saving them. When in fact he kind of, all he did was turn off a light and turn off the AC, according to some, and according to some he didn't. And then he ran out of the place through an exit that none of the others came through. And they remain hunkered down for 5 hours. He's since been made a citizen of France.
That's right. Yep.
Held up as a hero. Yeah. But it seems, though, that Koulibaly did not have the goal of killing as many people as possible, because throughout the 5 hours, he only killed one other person. And that was while he was actually making sandwiches while he was there as well, and passing the time and discussing politics with people. And one of the guys ran for one of his guns to try and, you know, take over. And then Koulibaly grabbed another gun and shot this guy dead. And that was the fourth and last of the murders. So it seems odd, yeah, that he would kill so few when he had the opportunity to kill so many. But I don't know if we can ever really answer that question. And then, like I mentioned earlier, he spent the rest of the afternoon as well, watching BFM TV out of the corner of his eye, waiting for the Kouachi brothers to call in, and then after that he called in and spoke to a journalist, and gave his motivations for what he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the one thing is in terms of the videos that are circulating, and oddly enough, I've only seen this one on Daily Motion, which is much more popular in France than the United States, and I haven't seen any English translations of it yet. That is that Koulibaly, so his last moments was when the SWAT team opened the metal door outside. And the way they were, it would be hard to describe. I would suggest people to go watch the video. The way that they were standing was standing upright in front of the window, shooting forward in a way that exposes their whole bodies to being shot back at. One of the SWAT teams runs inside as well, only one. Another thing that's very odd tactically.
Yeah.
And then you see after a few seconds, Koulibaly runs towards the door, kind of jumps, and he spins in the air as they're all shooting at him, and it looks like his hands are handcuffed together. Why? I don't know. I really have no idea what's going on there. I've seen no explanation for why this would be. And then also they were shooting towards him from each side. So then we've already talked about how bullets bounce on sidewalks.
Yeah.
That's very dangerous, and people who are that well trained would be trained not to do such a thing. Now, that being said, it's very possible, they should have expected him to have a suicide belt on. He didn't, luckily. But it would be very typical for this kind of jihadi to have a suicide belt on throughout the operation. And it's also very possible for him to have a dead man's grip trigger, where it does not get triggered as long as he holds his fist tight around the trigger, but if he loosens his hand, then it blows up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they should have also expected that. They didn't run away, though, when he came outside and when they killed him. So it's a very strange end to his life, and I don't really know why. And the accounts that I've seen from the people inside the store don't really cover the end so well. They'll mention that they were texting back and forth with the cops the entire time on their phones because he was very casual. Very casual with the people he was holding hostage there. And they texted him to say that he was starting to pray, and that was when they timed their entry. So strange.
It is strange. It's very bizarre. And I remember watching the video. I saw a couple of other people that saw this as a conspiracy too, then, because they were... One of the angles of the video was that they were like, wait a minute, what are they doing? They're literally shooting each other, you know, the cops who saw that from this one angle. And then someone linked up a different video, and you could clearly see that it was kind of wide open, and they were shooting at the right target. But nonetheless, there's something that's not right with it. I can't put my finger on it. The way that the cops acted, the way that he's just kind of running out, I guess that's how he wanted to go out. He wanted to, like, sacrifice himself, become a martyr. He just ran into the bullets, right?
Yeah, perhaps. And yeah, if you've seen more than I have on this, please feel free to share it. But I have a lot of unanswered questions with that.
Yeah, but it's definitely, I remember this on one of the Live Leak channels. We'll link to this, folks, as well, so you can just check the videos and the footage. But, I mean, that's clearly, you see the body. There's two photos linked up under this particular video. And it's a very gruesome scene, so warning on the graphic stuff there. But he's definitely shot, in the head multiple times. You see there's a lot of blood and stuff like that, too. So.
Okay. Actually, I haven't seen that one you're describing there.
Okay.
I haven't seen this one, yeah.
I'll make sure to send that to you, actually, so you can take a look at that, because that'd be something to stage, I think. I don't think it's fake. It's not that, but the actions of it is fake. Well, what about his girlfriend there, then? I mean, some people said it was... kind of a honeypot. She drew him into this Boumediene. How do you pronounce that? Do you know?
Boumediene. Yeah. So she was basically set up with Koulibaly, almost like an arranged marriage. And actually, you see this quite often in the jihadist milieu, where the more senior guys will set up their best juniors with wives. She's also an Algerian. So I should go a bit more into detail about the background of these three young men. And they have the typical background of these young French immigrants or children of immigrants who turn towards jihadist terrorism. They start out as, some of them are good students, some of them are not so good students. But once they hit their teenage years, they kind of can't stand French society, they can't stand rules, and they can't stand being second place at anything, whether they deserve it or not. And they start doing little crimes, you know, stealing an iPhone, stealing a scooter, and they go in and out of jail. Now with Sharif Kouachi and Amedy Coulibaly, they were both in the same jail, and they were in jail with an Algerian terrorist from the armed Islamic group, which was very active in the Algerian civil war of the 1990s. And this was a very, very violent civil war where there was just a lot of senseless violence. And it eventually spilled over into France as well with bombings of trains. There were never really clear objectives. It was really just very nihilistic violence. And this guy was there in the cell above Coulibaly. He was in solitary confinement. And they interacted, I guess, the way prisoners do with, I don't know, tap codes or passing little notes or shouting through an air duct or something like this. Mm-hmm. And they got to know each other very well. Coulibaly started to find meaning and structure in his life through radical Islam, which was what this guy promoted to him. And he said, hey, you should hang out with this guy, Sharif Kouachi. You guys will get along. And so then they spent, when he would go out in the yard from then on, these guys spent a lot of time together. Now, Coulibaly left prison. He got a job at Coca-Cola. He was employee of the month. And he was even invited to the Élysée Palace when Sarkozy was president.
Exactly. 2009, right?
Yeah. Now, I've heard this said that it was a meeting with intelligence or something like this. This was a pure photo op event where it was, you know, outreach to the ghetto. And it was, and this is central to Sarkozy's idea, was that, you know, if you work hard and if you believe in some of the basic values of France, then you're French. And basically exporting the creedal nation concept of the United States and the centrality of capitalism and putting it in France. And so this would be an excellent example. You know, this young African man who turned his life around and is now dedicated to hard work. And the funniest thing of all was he was even quoted in the newspaper. And he said things like, oh, yeah, you know, Sarkozy, people don't like him out in the ghetto, but, you know, they don't really like any politician, so it's not personal, you know. and he had pictures that were found in his belongings of himself there, pictures of the president from very near distances. But all along, he was still hanging out with the Kouachi brothers, and when the Algerian terrorist from the armed Islamic group was released, he was released to Cantal, which is a very rustic part of France known more for its cheese and its cows. And he would go out there on the weekends, and they would hang out, and he would get taught about Islam, but they would also go jogging, try shooting some guns, doing some basic paramilitary training, all these kinds of things. And then it was in this period that he got to meet Hayat Boumediene, and they got married. There's a video that just recently was released of them casing a Jewish children's school a couple days in a row, I believe. They walked by and kind of looked around to see what kind of security there was, that kind of thing. Clearly thinking this was on their list of potential targets that they were considering back then. And, yeah, they did all sorts of things. Like so many other jihadists, they did all sorts of things that are, you know, not Sharia compliant. You know, they have pictures of themselves hanging out at the beach and in bathing suits and, mm-hmm. you know, all these kinds of things. But there's something that happens where these guys, they have a crisis in their lives, and they turn to Islam, they lean on Islam. And I think it's much easier for them and maybe much more – they find much more glory in the idea of being a martyr and of doing the fighting part, the part about, you know, the other parts about the restricting the fun you have in life is a lot harder to pull off, especially over a long life. And so that seems to have less of an appeal for some of these guys. But yeah, this is a thing we see over and over again, you know, where Mohamed Merah was, you know, definitely lived the life of a typical young guy in the ghetto. You know, the 9/11 attackers were going to strip clubs, this kind of thing. You know, if you believe that they were, you know, consciously involved in the attack, you know, that actually fits in with these other attacks that have been happening in Europe.
So they don't feel at home in the culture. They don't know where to turn. There's a kind of a desperation. They're kind of part of a not only a subculture, but perhaps even a kind of an underclass, you know, of sorts. Their unemployment rates are sky high among the Muslims, like there are in Sweden and other European countries as well. And so what I feel on top of it is that the intelligence services, the apparatus that are seeking to broaden the conflicts in the Middle East are obviously taking advantage of this, perhaps even in some cases letting up the guard, you know, making
right.
sure that this is something that continues. I don't know what level this goes on at, but I can't help to sense that this is part of the multicultural chaos cocktail that they're getting served for us here, right?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. And I think also that the intelligence services have been accused of this, and I think proven over and over again that they really love this kind of Salafi, jihadist, Sunni Islam, because they're so much easier to infiltrate and create little cells, because all they have to do is point to a couple lines in the Quran and say, see, there you have it. Now you need to do this. Whereas if you're talking about Shia, they're such a hierarchical sect of Islam. Think back to the Mahdi army in Baghdad and Muqtada al-Sadr. This guy took a break. He was one of the major poles of power in that city. He was leading this paramilitary organization, and he takes a break at one point to go and essentially pursue postgraduate studies in Iran. Why? Because after a certain age or an amount of time, if he doesn't raise his level of studies and his become a higher level of Ayatollah, he won't have the respect or the ability to command the loyalty of his fellow Shia. So if you're a Western intelligence agency and you're looking at this, it's like, okay, how to manipulate Shia Islam to your advantage? Well, you have to have a guy who you can send to, for 20 years to study stuff, and then maybe he'll have the charisma to lead a group. Whereas if you're talking about Sunni Islam, all you have to do is find a few disaffected guys and have a passing familiarity with the Quran. And a nice beard and pull your pants up a little bit or roll your pant legs up, and that's it.
Now, some say that it was a security risk to let Sarkozy meet with Koulibaly, since he already kind of was known at the time by he had some crime background and stuff like that, kind of implying in a sense that he was manageable in some capacity. Is this a non-issue, do you think? Is that a coincidence, or is there something more to that?
Okay. So when he met with Sarkozy, that was before he was arrested for terrorism. He met with Sarkozy in the summer of 2009, and his later arrest for terrorism was in May of 2010. And that was an attempt to break out of prison one of these Algerian terrorists. I mentioned earlier the Algerian Islamist who bombed the Paris trains in the 90s. This is one of the guys who was responsible for that, and he's still in prison now. I don't know how developed their plans were, and that may explain why they went to jail for such a short time. But there's definitely he was less of a security risk in 2009 than he was in 2010, with the information that the security services had at that time.
Yeah.
So and that kind of brings to the last kind of big picture takeaways from this, and that is that the establishment wants people to think Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is responsible, or ISIS is responsible. But the thing is, these guys between themselves really couldn't get it straight, because Koulibaly in the kosher market is saying that I work for ISIS. The brothers were saying we work for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and we're trained to do this by Anwar al-Awlaki, who, by the way, has been dead for quite some time now. Now, the only passing link that they have with the Arabian Peninsula, or with Yemen, I should say, the Kouachi brothers, is one of them studied Arabic there back in 2009, I believe it was. Now, this was also before he came back and he tried to bust the Algerian terrorist out of jail. Ironically, he was also friends with Umar Abdulmutallab, the underwear bomber, while they were there. However, it seems unlikely, though, that Saeed Kouachi, who was the junior brother in this interaction, was somehow being controlled by the FBI, like the underwear bomber was. And I guess also just I guess one last thing about that FBI. I'm sure some people are listening and saying like, oh, this guy he's full of crap. The FBI, everyone knows it's focused locally. The FBI has nothing to do with international stuff. You can go to the FBI site and you can see that they have an office in Abuja, Nigeria, Lagos, Nigeria, the hometown of the underwear bomber, and also in Accra in Ghana. And Ghana is where he flew from to begin his trip as the underwear bomber. So, and every year when they have to justify their budget to Congress, they have to say, you know, why do we have offices there when we already have the CIA? This is their excuse.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, my feeling is that these links are very weak with Yemen and Syria. It would be, you know, I write for Countercurrents, and Greg Johnson is the editor. Several years ago, he came to France and he met with a lot of nationalists there. He went to a big FN convention event there. And then, you know, he gets more and more involved in this movement and the white nationalist movement in America. And he's running this site Countercurrents now. Now, could someone say he is a French asset? Or a French-run white nationalist. You know, I think this is a bit silly and to say so. He's obviously shares some, you know, ideological base with people in France, and he comes back and he does things that demonstrate this. You know, these guys, same story. They're gonna, wherever they go in the world, they're gonna meet people who feel the same way about things they do. Yeah. They're gonna seek out links with people who feel the same way as they do. And also, they're even going to send emails back and forth with people who feel the same way they do, who they met years ago. But to say that these brothers are run by Yemen, by the Yemeni jihadists, that's a bit of a jump. That's a bit of a jump. And it's one that would benefit the NATO and the U.S. and the French goals for the region. It's one that would benefit the Israeli goals for the region, particularly regarding Syria. But it seems to me to be a much more local issue. This is about the failure to create a multicultural society and a multiracial society that involves Islam, that involves Algerians, that the differences and the conflicts are just too great to overcome.
Now, it's a good point there, because usually we get that kind of, it's guilt by association, really. You met with someone, or, you know, there's a photo up somewhere, or an email conversation that doesn't imply that you're in with them, or that, you know, everything you're doing is tied to their actions, etc. It's quite common, I think, for people to jump on that, you know, leap right away, in the same way that, you know, for example, Anwar al-Awlaki, he was a dinner guest, you know, at the Pentagon before,
right,
you know, 9/11 and stuff like that. These are very interesting things, and they should be, you know, drawn out into the open. But see, that doesn't mean that there aren't a true legitimate people who actually break off from, you know, either trying to get, you know, on the right foot on things, or they are. My point is, what I'm getting to here, as I'm stumbling with the words here, is basically to say that people can break off from something that they've started, even if it's a long time after or not. They can be invited by somebody. They can decide to go to an event or something, even as a potential, you know, let's check out what they know. You go there as a double agent, or you go there as a way to try to figure out what they want to figure out from you, etc. There's a number of these things that goes on underneath everything that people, I think, tend to forget. And just because they've met, it doesn't mean that they're in on everything they're doing together, right? I think it's important to point that out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, also, events happen that that change people's minds or make them take a stronger position. And so, you know, I'm sure that something happened. I'm sure that the Pentagon saw Anwar al-Awlaki and they said, oh, here's a very charismatic guy. You know, he was born in America. He understands what we're about. He knows that we have all the best intentions in the world towards the Middle East, and he can really help us to reach out to the Muslims. And he goes, you know, whether he bought into that or not, he gets a nice free dinner. He gets treated like an important person. He gets to be to spread what he feels is the truth about his religion to people who will be the ones behind the trigger, right? He can kind of calm them down, maybe, or whatever it might be, help them to, you know, to say like, all right, these are the things I think you shouldn't be doing, and maybe they won't do those things. And then when he sees that what's happening and it's, it just doesn't fit with his what he expected out of them, or it's he just can't stand seeing fellow Muslims attacked, then something snaps and he's like, all right, I'm going to do everything I can to go after these people.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You know, in old days, we hear about battles. There's been plenty of times when, you know, different chieftains or different tribes have met with each other and they've tried to come to a conclusion. And then, you know, a week or a month later, they're at war. You know,
yeah,
it's like these things happen, right? They do meet and they do try to figure things out, and eventually things go sour, it goes wrong, or they learn more about their enemy, and that might be the very reason why they turned against him. Who knows, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so, you know, what is this conspiracy theory? What is the conspiracy behind this? You know, the conspiracy is to try and say that this is something that's related to the Middle East conflicts for some, and that it requires more Western involvement. The conspiracy is, the biggest conspiracy going on now in France is between the media and the political elite to prevent people from linking radical Islam or Muslim or Arab immigration with this the rising risk and the rising level of intercommunitarian conflict in France. And this is the and they're willing to say and do anything, even if it looks totally idiotic and even if it's completely hypocritical, to promote this. You know, at the same time that they say we stand for freedom of expression, these are the same people who are within days putting Dieudonné before the court, threatening him with 5 years in jail for a very, light and difficult to understand statement, or let's say ambiguous statement, that he's Charlie, I am Charlie Coulibaly, mixing the I am Charlie and I am Coulibaly. And they're even arresting dozens and dozens of young people who say things that are, you know, disrespectful to the cops and making reference to this stuff. And they're going to jail for months for things that they said. So the hypocrisies are present, and they all have one goal, and that is to continue the replacement of the peoples of Europe and to continue the intervention of Western powers in the Middle East.
Yeah, I agree with you there. You raised some very good points that I think people should think about, and the possibility that we do have the reality of false flag attacks, and that doesn't mean that everything that does occur is going to be a false flag attack. It doesn't mean that they have control of everything. I think it's a tendency to kind of fall into that category too, that whatever goes on in the world, there's never any independent players that actually wield some kind of surprises out of the corners. I mean, yeah. I did hear the police talking about too that, you know, these people were obviously under, you know, surveillance, but after certain things, it dropped, and because they couldn't spend the resources on it. I mean, I don't know personally how many people they have watching over, but I mean, just think about the waste and the sloppiness overall of government, right? And I mean, that's a tremendous machinery that has to be continued to be oiled there. Sure, they do get a lot of money for this, but let's face it too, when these things occur, that's actually good for them, because that means now they'll get even more funding. I mean, the pressure now on cracking down on the internet and on travel, of sharing flight data between European countries, etc., it's perfect for the control grid, you know, and this is precisely what they want to have. So they're jumping on this. They're loving what has happened, you know?
Right. Absolutely. You know, I've been a long time subscriber. I should say I've been a long time listener to Red Ice Radio, even, you know, from back in the days when we had the Tibetan bowls beginning the show. and I've been a subscriber for about a year. And I just want to urge everyone out there listening, if you've made it this far and you're not a subscriber, please subscribe, because these guys are doing great work. Please encourage them to continue, and also listen to the second hour where we'll get into more, forbidden issues.
Absolutely. Very good. Thank you so much, Patrick, for that. I really appreciate that. And, definitely. I mean, we have much more to talk about here. We do have some interesting topics lined up. We want to talk about how this is being used by, you know, people like Netanyahu and Israel, and they're trying to get a majority of Jews to leave France and go back there, and how this is going to change things. You have a really interesting series that you wrote about that's up on Countercurrents that we're going to talk more about here in the second hour. But is there any website you'd like to leave us with? Anything else you'd like to plug, Patrick, or if, you know, where people can go and read more of your material or something like that?
Yeah, everything I've ever written is up at Countercurrents in English, everything I've written. And so, yeah, I'd encourage everyone, after you've subscribed to Red Ice Radio, go and give a donation to Countercurrents, because Greg Johnson also does excellent work. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And I think that if you enjoy the things you've been hearing on Red Ice Radio, I think you'd be very interested in, especially over the last few months, you know, I think you'd be very interested in checking out Countercurrents.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. And people, if you missed the interview that Lana did with Greg, check that out. It's over on radio314.com in the archives right there. Really good interview to get a little bit more insight into Countercurrents and what the publishing company is up to. A lot of good news articles, you know, analysis and things like that up there as well. So we'll have these linked up from our website. So do check it out, folks. All right, Patrick, we'll take a short break and then we'll be right back with more.
La mer, on va danser le long du golfe clair, à des reflets d'argent, la mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer, au ciel d'été, confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs, la mer, bergère d'azur, infinie. Voyez, près des étangs, ces grands roseaux mouillés. Voyez, ces oiseaux blancs, et ces maisons rouillées, la mer les a bercées le long des golfes clairs, et d'une chanson d'amour, la mer a bercé mon cœur pour la vie. La mer, qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs, à des reflets d'argent, la mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer, au ciel d'été, confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs, la mer, bergère d'azur, infinie. Voyez, près des étangs, des grands roseaux mouillés. Voyez, des oiseaux blancs, et ces maisons rouillées, la mer, les a bercées le long des golfes clairs, et une chanson d'amour là-bas a bercé mon cœur pour la vie.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, as we pick up here in the second hour, we'll look closer at Netanyahu, Israel, and the Jewish community in France, especially in Paris, as we start up here after the break. We are going to talk about the demographics question, both in Israel and in Europe, and look at how the establishment is using these events for their own distinct purposes. We'll also talk about the tension between the Orthodox and secular Jewish community in France and also in Israel. Later, we talk about what is going to happen here in the future, both with France and the French people, if things continue on this path of societal breakdown. We talk about Front National and Le Pen in France and other nationalist parties in Europe and look at how these things will progress here in future elections. So we'll continue at redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up and tune in and listen to all our programs in full. Enjoy our archives. Okay, our next program is going to be with Eric Karlstrom. Then we also have Richard Spencer, Jeff Gates, Octavian, Carl Lehrberger, and Sally Fallon, to name a few. But we'll be right back. Stay with us. Thank you so much for listening.